Hello, everybody out there on the internet, wherever you are. This is David Rovics with another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, as well as my own Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn channels. And it all these episodes also go out in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or go to davidrovics.com or get the David Rovics mobile app. And the Fifth Estate live podcast and live stream specifically can also be found at fifthestate.org. Fifth Estate is a quarterly publication, print publication, which you can, normally find out there in the world more easily than you can during the pandemic, but it still exists and you can get it mailed to you, and you can find it at some certain select demonstrations in various parts of the country. And again, you can find out about that at fifthestate.org. And I do other broadcasts on Wednesdays and Fridays. Generally, most weekdays I'm interviewing people, but Fifth Estate Live is on Tuesdays, and it is produced by Peter Werby, who is part of the editorial collective of the Fifth Estate magazine. And today, we are talking with an author of many books, an organizer of many conferences, a journalist who has written for many publications, who has a book coming out on AK Press in the spring of 2021, which is running along the bottom of the screen here for those who are watching in video form right now. And it's called, I love the title, The Operating System, An Anarchist Theory of the Modern State. And welcome to Fifth Estate Live once again to Eric Larson.
And thanks, Dave.
Great to have you back. And this book, I mean, it looks just fantastic. And all I've seen is just the synopsis. I guess these days, before you actually publish a book, it has a website for quite a while in advance. And I know from talking to Ramsey at PM Press that it's typical that books are written like a year or more before they're ever published. So timeliness of books is kind of hard to nail down, right? But this is, I mean, it's always a timely subject, I think. But at the moment, I think there are more people than ever in this society who are questioning what is the nature of the state and what good is this state that we got here that is totally incapable of dealing with the health crisis. And a lot of questions being asked. So it seems to me this is actually a really great time to be coming out with this book. And I wonder, can we just start there? Like, I mean, well, that is something you're running across too, I'm sure, in daily life. Like, people are really people who don't normally question a lot of these things are questioning a lot of these things.
Yeah, that's true. I think what we've seen, particularly this election season, has opened a lot of people's eyes to the let's just say the disrespect that the idea of democracy is, with which the idea of democracy is treated on an institutional level in this country. And we can talk about Trump, we can talk about the Republicans, but the reality is that we suddenly find ourselves in a political system that that has an enormous bag of tricks for keeping people from actually expressing their views and getting their views turned into policy at a national or state or even a local level. There are a multitude of things that can be done to fix elections, to manipulate elections, to manipulate voters, to play around with the mechanics of voting. And we're seeing a crash course in it right now across the country. The vote is something that is, it's a right. It is precious to people. It's something that people have fought and died over for hundreds of years in this country. And yet it's being treated in an incredibly disrespectful way. And again, I know that's a little bit of an understatement, by the very institutions that are supposed to honor democracy and commitment to democracy. And I think it's been a shock to a lot of people that the system is not just not working the way it's supposed to be, but it's working antithetically to the very idea of democracy.
I mean, Of course, the system has been not working in so many ways for so long in terms of like the democracy or as a supposed representative democracy. But what's been happening recently, I think, has probably opened up a lot more eyes in terms of the, like, as you say, the complete, how completely blatant it is. Like with the, and I don't know how many people are necessarily aware of the timeline here, but like with the Voting Rights Act in the 1965, right? Yeah. And that was basically, until 2013, the all the different states had to get federal, had basically it had some form of federal oversight and couldn't just bar half their population from voting. And I think over all those decades, I guess people eventually, or a lot of journalists, politicians, regular people who, you know, probably just assumed that, okay, those days are over and now we don't need the Voting Rights Act anymore. And the Supreme Court got rid of it, right? In 2013, I think it was how it stopped. And then what we've seen since then is actually states are, particularly Republican-led states, if I'm not mistaken, are just trashing the whole idea of representative democracy.
Well, yes, but think back a little further than the Citizens United case and that Supreme Court decision that essentially neutered the Voting Rights Act. Go back to 2000 with the Bush-Gore election. One of the revelations of that election to people was the extent to which the states of the former Confederacy, after the Civil Rights Act and after the Voting Rights Act, passed a blizzard of laws that essentially made it more and more difficult for people to get to the polls, i.e. working people, people of color, the hours on which polling stations were open, the places they were located. They had a million different ways to disenfranchise people. And a lot of that became very, very clear, was exposed to the light of day during the 2000 election. And it came as quite a shock. But that's something that had been going on almost as soon as the Voting Rights Act was passed. Southern legislatures started to come up with more ways to subtly enforce the same kind of restrictions. And the Citizens United case was, in a way, simply the culmination of that.
Yep. You know, I just love the title of the book. And I don't know, like, I mean, having, you know, as a writer and a reader myself, I think it's kind of overlooked by many, the incredible power of the title of a book and how much that impacts the reader's whole orientation as they're reading the book. I mean, I've just, you know, the book by Primo Levi called Surviving Auschwitz was originally titled If This Be a Man. And that was the first introduction to this concept of how powerful a title can be. But man, it's just like a whole different read if you are, you know, if you know what the title was supposed to be. Sure. But the operating system, it just seems like it gets to the very core of what this whole question is of what is the state and all these kinds of assumptions that people make that are sort of on faith or sort of religious assumptions about almost as if there are natural laws that determine things like who are the landlords and who are the tenants and who the caste system in our society. It's almost as if these things are just being kind of like we can't just have a whole different kind of arrangement of relations between people in society as if it's not something that people decided on in the first place. And it seems like that sort of religious connection to the idea that this is sort of immutable is a very important part of the whole setup here, isn't it? Would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, without giving away the game too much, I mean, the origin of the title is simply this perception or realization that I have that a state is very much like a computer operating system. It's something that's designed by people to create a kind of an environment that other people can operate within, and that gives them at least the illusion that they can do anything they want, anything that's important to themselves in their lives through this operating system, and that the people who design that system are the creators, but as they give way to other programmers and other programmers, the operating system essentially rules them and dictates the direction they go in developing it. And I think that's very much the way the state has evolved over the last 500 years, and particularly over the last 100 years, is that it's an operating system that trains us to think a certain way. It trains us to obey in certain ways. It sets subtle boundaries for us, and it seduces us with a certain kind of familiarity and sameness, thematic sameness that we sort of we absorb into ourselves. And this is a real barrier to change today. It's we live at a critical time when we have problems like climate change. We have problems like tremendous inequality via the neoliberal economic system, something that's sometimes overlooked, although not increasingly not so, which is the fact that we're becoming a more multicultural, truly global society, which can be fine in terms of diversity, but it can also, if in the hands of a neoliberal economy, it can turn the world into more of an uneven, forced labor, unequal, discriminatory society than it's ever been. And I bring those three things up to simply illustrate the fact that the state is created this situation. It seduces us, but we have to try and think outside of it. We have to try and go beyond it if we want to solve these kinds of problems.
Mm. And I mean, one of the things about the state generally is that regardless of all the stuff they say about how it is sort of a like the structure that we all can work within and it's all going to work out if we play by the rules, the reality is that it's all these good terms have been used too much by Trump. It gets every time I say things like rigged, you know, it's like, okay, this is Trump's favorite word, but it is a totally rigged it is a totally rigged system, and it's structurally supposed to be that way. But at the same time, it requires the consent of the governed. They can govern by force, but they can only do that to a certain degree, and everything falls apart. They have to really have our cooperation for the most part, most of the time, the vast majority of the time, right? And that is currently, I think the reason why so many people are questioning the basic structure of the state today, right now in this country, is that it's not working. You know, it's really, really not working. You know, like it's really failing really badly for most people, right? As opposed to just failing for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. And not only are we seeing it not working, we're seeing it lash back at us in the form of incredibly repressive response to the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. That protest is being once again declared or treated as illegal by the authorities. Certainly that has a lot to do with the administration in office, but I think that that's a reflection of it's for a long time that's been a reflection of the systems or the state's fundamental attitude towards protest and dissent, unless it's politically acceptable dissent. In other words, if you wear a Proud Boys T-shirt or something like that. But it's a system that doesn't work, and that we've seen in very dramatic fashion how it works against us.
Right, and then. Then to the extent that the part of the system that I would say in some sense is working is the at least whatever element within the government bureaucracy known as the Centers for Disease Control that decided there should be a moratorium on evictions up until the end of December. Because if they had not done that, I don't know if you thought about what would society be like right now. If that moratorium did not exist, what would be happening? How many people would have been on the streets of Houston right now? I mean, they're already evicting people in places all over the country, right? Not here in Oregon so much, but you know, because we have our own state laws around these things that are better than the federal laws, as many states do, but many states don't, and they have a whole lot of millions and millions of poor people living in Class C housing, the vast majority of whom are currently in some situation of either facing eviction or they don't know where they're going to come up with next month's rent.
Yeah, the the reality there is that to the extent that people are still in their homes and aren't living out on the street, it's for two reasons. Number one is that, as you say, the Centers for Disease Control and their actions. Number two, the income subsidies that were included in the first stimulus bill that was passed a few months ago when the crisis began. That's running out now. Another stimulus bill has become a political hostage. It's not getting passed. That being the case, the one thing that has prevented up to now a big surge in evictions is the fact that people are mobilized around it. That in cities, not just in Oregon, in New York City, in Boston, other big cities, tenants' rights movements have been growing and growing and getting more powerful in the last several years, have really been mobilized around this. And so there is some fear among landlords and also among investors in property-owning companies to be seen as throwing people out on the street. But that fear goes away as soon as people get out of the street and stop making noise about it. So it's critical that what we have going on in terms of protest continue to build into a stronger and stronger social movement. That's what keeps people in their homes.
Right. Absolutely. But it's also the, I think some of the more intelligent minds in the government are also capable of imagining what might happen, I'm quite certain that they are very much influenced by organizing on the ground, but it also seems like you don't have to be very intelligent to be able to figure out what's going to happen when this moratorium is lifted. And of course, the kind of resistance that could be unleashed by the government making that kind of a critical mistake of ending the moratorium without a new aid package first. It would be it's the sort of mistake that I guess a lot of radicals, maybe the more the ones who are hoping, for the government to make really big mistakes that we might be able to potentially take advantage of, even though it will, in the interim, it will mean a whole lot of people suffering. But I mean, these are some harsh calculations, but lots of people are making them, both among organizers on the streets and among the top politicians in the land. Huh?
Sure.
When I am speaking with various radicals about the nature of the state, I find that there's a tendency, especially among U.S.-based anarchists, to dismiss the state generally as something that doesn't work sort of equally badly all over the place. And I, as somebody who spends half of my time in, used to spend half my time touring in Europe, I have to make the point that states vary dramatically one from another. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's true. There are, and especially, it's interesting you mentioned Europe, because on the grassroots level there, there are a lot more directly democratic ways to influence policy in those countries than there are here. There's not a lot of outlets to influence policy in this country aside from voting and getting out in the street and making a lot of noise. In Europe, there literally are consultative groups in some countries, Scandinavian countries, for example, that allow people to have a direct voice in some policy making, and that's a big difference. That's quite a big difference. And it's true that there are differences between large. You can't compare a state like the U.S., which essentially regards itself and acts like an empire, to a state like even in Italy or Belgium, or a state on that level, is sort of a mid-sized state whose ambitions are mostly within its own borders. There's a very big difference. But what I try to do in my book is to point out the similarities and understand what the state is on a kind of a global level. Because I don't think of the state as being simply government or governmental institutions. It includes many other institutions that are tightly interlocked with the state. So corporations, for example, political parties that are official parties like the Republicans and Democrats, who to some extent are subsidized tacitly and overtly by the state. Nonprofit organizations that help to marshal the money of large donors for various causes, households to some extent, which are encouraged to structure themselves in certain ways by the tax system and other elements of the state policymaking. All of that goes into a kind of an overall system that I call the state with a capital S, which is different from individual states. And that's the operating system that we live within. Whether you're in the United States or Russia or China or Bulgaria, you live within some version of this. And that's what I'm sort of what I'm trying to critique in my book. I think that in some places, yeah, it's more benign. But if you live within one of these countries, you also live in a world that is regulated by states. You have passports. You have rules governing commerce. You have rules governing the environment. You have rules that are made by states, not just individually, but collectively, so that you have a kind of an overall system here that applies to all of us. You know, the reality is that even 100 years ago, there was a pretty substantial part of the world's population that didn't live within states. Or if it did, they didn't have a whole lot of their writ didn't carry very far. You had people living in the highlands of Haiti, for example, before the U.S. invasion, which essentially began opening that place up, who really didn't care what happened in the central government. It didn't really affect them. You had people in Tibet or Mongolia who lived according to a very traditional system that didn't include a state. Most of that's ended. In most places, there are only pockets where that kind of non-state existence still survives today. And so there is a real kind of impulse on our part to think of the state as this is what we have. This is what there is. What else is there in the world? You know, and that's what I think we have to kind of mentally wean ourselves away from.
And why did you feel like it was important to come up with this term state with a capital S? I mean, as opposed to just calling it something else like the powers that be or the power structure or the system, as they used to say in the 60s. Or, I mean, I guess it makes me cringe even to say the system, because even though I think it's very descriptive, it's so dated. But so you had to come up with something else, because we can't use the system, right? But yeah. Or the man. We definitely can't call it the man.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I just precede my answer to that question by saying that I do really believe that the important thing here is to keep your eye on the institutions and not on the individuals. That Trump, for example, is a bad person. Boris Johnson is a bad person. But it's the system and the way they alter the system or contribute to its development that is the important thing. Now, I was going to try one more on you, David, the deep state. How about the deep state?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, that was nice until Trump got a hold of it.
Yeah, yeah, there's some validity to that description of things. There is a kind of a continuum of the state that perpetuates itself no matter what figurehead's in charge of it. But yeah, the system, the deep state, the man, you know, the corporation. There was in the 60s, people sometimes the corporation with a capital C. Mm. And I looked at each of those and I thought there's some element of descriptive accuracy to some of that. But really what we're talking about is the state. I simply couldn't come up with any other word for it. But I figured it's the state with a capital S because I want to emphasize that it's an operating system. It's not a specific thing. It's not a specific geographic entity. It's the collectivity of this. It's the system. So I thought operating system was a great one, and I thought that I wanted to maintain this emphasis on the state, because the state is not just an administrative thing; it's an identity. It's an identity where we assume we have passports that state that we are American citizens or Canadian citizens or something like that. And so I couldn't really think of any other term that captured that idea of this being an entity that we are part of, you know, just by the virtue of the fact that we live and we're born here or moved here. So I don't know if that's
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit guess, of the answer, but
no, that's a very clear answer. And then once we have this, once we have the concept of what it is that is the problem, then I guess there's always the big hurdles of not only how could life be different, but how do we get there? And I just feel like there's, I mean, as it's so important to be able to imagine how things, how society could be so structured so differently than it is now. And yet my feeling about it is that it's that there's a lot more good ideas for how to structure society differently than there are good ideas for how to implement that. But it's, of course, as Sartre said, I think, what is it? The football is made endlessly more complex by the existence of the opposing team. So I guess when it comes to implementation, you have the entire capitalist class and all of their servants arrayed against you. But sure. But in terms of at least imagining, perhaps the lesser or maybe equally important, but maybe easier of the two, in terms of implementation versus imagining, but how could things be structured so differently without the capital S state?
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, I think on a very grassroots level, there are some tremendous experiments going on with that in the world. We see that in, or we did see that in Rojava. We see that in the Zapatista uprising, for example, and in other social movements that have taken on kind of more than just a social movement type of structure, like the movement of the landless in Brazil or the farmers movement in India, for example. So we do see those things happening on a level where people understand that they have to make social changes in their immediate environment. And then they start to think about how those social changes dictate political changes. And that's always the way I think it needs to happen. It needs to happen organically, starting with the local and the social, and then making the politics accommodate to that sphere. Now, fortunately, we can look at the evolution of the state itself, and we can get some ideas for what some of the other elements can be. For example, Social Security, which I've written about pretty extensively. The social security system, or the social insurance system, which is the sort of contributory old age and survivors benefit program, which the government runs, but we all contribute specifically to it. It actually grew out of ideas on how to organize large scale mutual aid that developed in the anarchist movement in the 19th century. One of the first programmatic efforts to spell out how something like that would work was actually developed by Proudhon, the French anarchist, in the 1850s. And it was then picked up on by social democrats and then by sort of more conventional liberals. And we have the social security system we have today. The jury system is something that was actually much more grassroots and much more, it had a much wider range of authority, and it was populated by everyday people back in, if you want to look at English history, back in the 12th century. It's something that was guaranteed in the Magna Carta. And the jury system has been co-opted and cheapened and run down and turned into a kind of a servant of the courts in the current system we have now. But those systems, the elements that made them a more non-hierarchical, socially based thing back when they were originated are still there. It would be possible to take a system like Social Security or disability insurance and remake it outside the government or move it outside the government. It's possible to revive the jury system as it existed hundreds of years ago and move it out of the criminal justice system. Now, there's a lot, that's opening up a big can of worms in terms of how you actually get there. But the institutions are the institutions with a small I that people in communities built up or formulated for themselves hundreds of years ago still exist inside of the state, and they can be recouped by the people. So we don't have to totally reinvent the wheel. We simply have to take back these things and reshape them the way we want, so they function the way we want them to. Now, again, that's a tall order, but it's not like we have to completely reinvent everything either.
It's important that there are all sorts of current and historical examples of how people can organize society so differently. And then also, what about in terms of, I wonder if you want to talk more about the Zapatistas or Rojava, because it seems like those are the two, and both, especially Rojava, so much under siege constantly, that the idea of even talking about the achievements of either of these parts of the world is just astounding that anything has been achieved under the circumstances. But they're both important examples, as is other sort of more distant history, but not, you know, depending on how we go with history, it's not that distant in terms of like what happened in Spain, I guess now 90 years ago, 80 years ago. But sure. Maybe talk a little about some of the more concrete recent examples of implementation of these kinds of ideas.
Rojava was actually one of several experiments that have happened in Syria over the period of the civil war there. I would say when I'm feeling pessimistic, what I tend to say to myself is that what happened in Rojava was a tragedy to the extent that it was ground between two big mill wheels of the Syrian dictatorship of Assad and the nationalism of Turkey. And when it looked like defending it and standing up for it would be too difficult, the United States, for example, just basically, kicked it out the door. That's the reality is that when movements like this arise, the state, and this is another reason why I like to talk about the state with a capital S, is you've got the United States, Turkey, Syria, all of which have very profoundly different interests in that region, somehow managed to see it clear among the three of them to crush Rojava. It's amazing how this sort of harmonic convergence happens when the state really needs to work together to stop something.
Isn't it?
Threat.
I think one of the more I'm not really up on this history, but I think you might be. There was one of the more notable examples of this kind of thing was. Oh, my mic just went off and now it's back on. I don't know. But after the Paris Commune, I believe France and Prussia were at war at the time that the uprising in Paris happened. And then when the French army and the Prussian army, after fighting each other, joined forces to put, right? Isn't it? They had a truce or something. What happened? It was one of those classic examples of everybody gangs up against the working class when there's that kind of uprising going on. But you could probably fill in the details a bit better. But
that's essentially what happened is the French army had been defeated. It needed help to put down this uprising, and the Prussian army was there. It was powerful. It was they were feeling good, and so they said, "Let's help out." There was a very clear understanding that this is something they couldn't allow to happen. I mean, keep in mind that the Commune happened within living memory of a lot of people who lived through the French Revolution, and nobody wanted to in the power structure wanted to see that happen again. Mm. So yeah, this happens. But you'd asked me to be I think your question was a little bit more in a hopeful vein. Is how can these movements succeed, or how can they survive and generate something and generate more of the same? Mm-hmm. The reality is that I think this is not to lapse back into pessimism, but I think what has to happen is the left around the world has to become far better at working together and supporting itself. That there was a lot of effort to support Rojava, including by our late mutual friend David Graeber, was very organized, very, very involved with that. But I think that the pressure just wasn't there. The participation just wasn't there. And I think as a global left, we have to think more about where the hotspots are and where our energy needs to go. That's not something that anybody can legislate, but the communication and the levels of understanding need to grow. And we need to understand that we don't just represent isolated communities. We represent more like a school of fish, you know, that, mm-hmm. that has to sort of work together to survive, you know, if you will.
When I talk to a lot of people about just the past few decades in the United States, in terms of the various efforts to organize social movements that have, to one degree or another, had their impacts, although at the current moment, it's kind of hard to think about good things that social movements have accomplished in the past few decades, because here we are. But the fact is, it seems to me that that maybe all of the most successful social movements of my lifetime have been organized by anarchists, and that just seems to be a fact, not an ideological thing that I'm attached to, because I'd be happy to see other people organize great stuff. But it just seems to be, that's the reality when I think about the global justice movement, Occupy Wall Street, and so many other of the more prominent viral movements that we've had in this country. In many ways, the more sort of grassroots elements of the anti-war movement, there were bigger organizations that were more, top-down organizations, but by and large, it was a grassroots, very, very horizontal affair. And I wonder what if you have any comments on that, because it's just a conversation I'm often getting in when people are saying, well, you know, anarchism is the solution. And then I turn the question back at them, like, look at everything that's happening in our lifetimes. If I'm talking to another person in the United States, like, look at all the social movements, who's been organizing them, and, you know, who else has been doing anything particularly useful? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I can address that. I mean, I think you have to be a little careful. The Black Lives Matter movement wasn't a specific, or isn't a specifically anarchist movement, right. For example. And the Black community has been organizing to liberate itself for many, many, many decades without that kind of ideological overtone on it.
And that's a really important point. But I just also would point out about Black Lives Matter that they are so that the movement is so tuned into the idea of not backing Democratic politicians, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that like a lot of social movements in this country and elsewhere, they partake of anarchist ideas and anarchist methods of organizing and thinking strategically, even if they're not aware of it. And yeah, I think that was the thing that convinced me that Black Lives Matter was something that was going to last and was going to really grow, is the fact that they didn't anchor themselves to a political party or to political candidates, that they weren't going to become a cog in a machine, that this was going to continue to be a social movement that got its energy from the bottom up.
Although another thing I would just mention about the global justice movement in the late 90s, particularly, that although although my personal knowledge of many of the organizers is what tells me that they are anarchists, but it's not like most people organizing the protests at the time were using the term in any kind of prominent way in press releases and stuff like that, right? It was also just something that many people knew if they knew that, right? But it wasn't like, yeah.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It didn't have a big circle A stuck on the logo someplace. It was an attempt to use anarchist organizing, you know, consciously or unconsciously, to create a friendly organizing and useful and flexible organizing environment for a much larger movement. Is how I would put it.
Mm.
And it succeeded to a large extent, and movements have continued to organize themselves that way ever since.
Mm-hmm. And these ideas, the way that when you are sticking to certain organizing principles, the organizing principles are the thing that spreads rather than the organization, and that tends to often work very well, doesn't it? I mean, especially if it's backed up by some kind of something pushing it along. I don't know if you can talk about a bit more of those kinds of organizing principles, because especially for many people who were not around for the global justice movement and have never been to a spokes council meeting.
Yeah. I remember it was a real watershed moment in 2000 or 2001, I guess, when Time Magazine published a big piece about the global justice movement that had a diagram of the spokes council and it described in some detail how it worked. I think that's the reality of the slogan, you know, the personal is political on a certain level, is the fact that what we imbibe from the movement in terms of how we organize is what we really take away from it. That really is the meat of it. That's the substance of the movement. And once we experience that, we take it with them and it changes our expectations, especially in terms of the amount of input that we have ourselves. If you participate in a directly democratic protest or activist network where you have a direct voice, where you have a spokes council that allows you to participate in a very direct way, it's very tough to leave that and to go back into traditional political organizing on a sort of a campaign or, you know, candidate level. Because suddenly you're just a piece in a bigger machine. You know, you get conditioned to want more in terms of organizing. And so I think that it really does change people and it changes expectations in a really important way.
It would be kind of hard to even try to quantify the impact that the Zapatistas had on the world, right? I mean, and the way that worked, which had nothing to do with any sort of organization trying to push their principles, not at all. In fact, I mean, the Zapatistas have generally, for most of their existence, been, I don't know if the word would be sort of, I don't know, they keep to themselves for the most part. They're, it's not like an extrovert sort of organization. I'm not sure what the term I'm looking at. You know, they're not vanguardist in any possible sense of the word. And yet, of course, they're conducting things according to a model that a whole lot of people are wanting to attempt to emulate. Although, obviously, for most people in the world, there are basic structural problems with trying to emulate the model, like the fact that they have to pay rent to a landlord or a bank or something along, or that they're being attacked by the police on a daily basis, or any number of other problems that the Zapatistas tend not to have in the jungle there.
Right, right, right. We don't have the luxury of living in the jungle. That's the reality. But the other thing about the Zapatistas that I have always admired is that when they do interact with the larger society in Mexico or internationally, it's been through convening forums, convening social forums, convening people to talk and to discuss and to share ideas. They don't claim to have the perfect structure for every place, but they do claim to, with very good will, want people to come together and talk about what kinds of things they can do in a commonality and what kinds of things work for them individually. So I think that they've gone out of their way to create more of a global network because they know that ultimately that global network is what's going to allow them to survive for the long run. So it gets back to this point I wanted to make earlier, which is that we have to think of ourselves as a kind of as activists as part of a global ecosystem of activism, of change, of social change and political change. If we don't, we're going to be isolated. And the Zapatistas to this day, I think, depend a lot on the attention that is focused on them internationally. That's what keeps the Mexican government from becoming really heavy-handed with them. Of course, they do it themselves, but you know that kind of global community is extremely important.
Really, yeah. And so, I was thinking about just backing up from the actual subject material of your book and talking about actually publishing a book. Because I've been reading a wonderful book that just came out last month. I'm about two-thirds of the way into it, called The Death of the Artist, which is just a fantastic condemnation of 21st century capitalism and how it's destroyed so many industries, from journalism to music to visual arts to sculpture. I mean, it just goes down the line, and that's just in the arts. Obviously, not even talking about so many other industries, but like, of course, the taxi industry being one fairly prominent example, because so many of these corporations that are just destroying the arts are very much modeled after Uber, or vice versa. But I wonder, just talk about like the reality of writing and putting out a book in the modern in this modern situation. I mean, just I don't know. There's so many different approaches to that question, and I don't know what will come to mind to you and to talk about it. But the kind of more and more what I think about as an artist who is still surviving as an artist, believe it or not, is how few people are possibly doing that. Like writers, musicians, I mean, is it a coincidence that you and I are both, white guys from a middle-class kind of background from the Northeast, you know? I mean, not that most white guys can afford to be artists either, but right. When we look at the statistics now, 4 out of 5 people who survive as artists today in the United States are white men. Yeah. According to this, but I think we're white, maybe white, maybe that includes, I can't remember if that includes white women too, but it's astounding anyway.
Yeah. Either way, that statistic would hit home. And unfortunately it just sounds really correct to me. I've been working for a while on a book about a writer, Alex Comfort, who's a British anarchist, biologist, poet. He died in 2000. He wrote a famous bestseller in the 70s called The Joy of Sex, and I'm hoping to finish that book up the end of next year. And I talked to a lot of people in publishing. He published over 50 books. I talked to a lot of people in publishing who worked with him over the course of his career, with big publishing houses. And they all told me that you talked a lot to me about how the economics of book publishing has changed. That back then, there was still among people who you'd call capitalists or business people, there was still kind of a sense that not everything can or should be ruled by the market. That you know, in publishing, you have mid-list, you have loss leaders, you don't expect every book to be a blockbuster or a potential blockbuster. And the more brutal economy we've had over the last 40 to 50 years has completely changed that. None of that's tolerated anymore. And most of these people said to me, you know, it's not fun anymore. Publishing is now a kind of a brutal exercise. And that's the reality for a lot of people. On the one hand, and I'm sure you notice this as well in as a musician, is you can produce music and you can produce writing like you wouldn't believe. I mean, you can record the stuff. You can do it all at home. It's become very DIY on a certain level, but actually getting in front of an audience, actually getting it out there is a whole different story, and it's become colossally competitive and colossally profit ridden. And I mean, the fortunate thing for me is that I have a publisher, AK Press, that does amazing work, that isn't trying to turn itself into the next tech IPO or something like that, is very supportive of its writers and does a great job. That doesn't mean that it's easy for me to make a living doing this stuff.
Because it's not like AKK Press. For anybody who is not aware of the modern situation with writing, it used to be like before I was, I don't know, I guess when I was a kid, maybe that writers getting advances in the tens of thousands to write a book that the publisher didn't even have great confidence was going to become a bestseller or anything. That was very normal, right? Although rejections were also very normal. But of course, getting publishing contracts like that was normal. Whereas even if you'd get a publishing contract with a wonderful independent publisher like AK Press, this doesn't come with tens of thousands of dollars for you to take some time to write the book. You have to, I don't know if you want to get into these kinds of details, but I don't think there's even an advance involved, right?
If there is, it's very modest, and it's more of a sort of a token of support than, you know, in the old days, people could get $10,000 to $20,000 advances and at least kind of eke out a marginal, you know, living that way.
The time it took to write the book, at least, right? I mean, if it's going to take you 6 months to write a book, at least you theoretically, you need an advance that's going to allow you to survive for 6 months at least, right? While you write the book.
Yeah, that's not in the cards anymore, even for people who write for very large scale publishing houses. Only people who are guaranteed bestsellers get big advances. The reality for us is that as writers or artists, is we have to support ourselves doing this. We have to figure out some way to make it work within the margins. The only thing we can really do that to have some control is to just really work hard at getting the material out there. And you go on tour, you perform in various places, and you which is partly although that's a form of your artistic expression, but it's also marketing yourself. It's getting yourself known, making yourself a presence and an active presence in the lives of the people who can enjoy your music. And that's what I have to do by going on tour to support a book, for example, or having a presence online and so forth. But it's very much you have to do it yourself.
And how's that, especially during the pandemic, how is that working in terms of any kind of a tour plan? Are you in touch with, I'm sure you're in touch with folks at AK Press about this release, because this is we're in the cycle now, I guess is what they call it, right? But how are they, are you trying to deal with that problem?
Well, for one thing, we're crossing our fingers, and we haven't talked about it a lot yet, but we're crossing our fingers and hoping that things will be a little more, dare I say, back to normal by spring. Which will allow me to get out and actually do some traveling to support the book. The one thing that has been helpful is that there's a lot more. There seems to be a hunger for book talks and music performances online, and so there's more possibilities for doing that. I have a good friend who just published a major biography, 2-volume biography of William Faulkner. And it came out right when the pandemic hit. But he's been able to do appearances at a lot of the bookstores he was planning to go to online. They've arranged online sessions, presentations and so forth. And actually, he winds up being viewed by more people that way than he would have actually in person. So, you know, we're all adjusting to some extent to this, and it's good that there's more ways to do this online. You do performances online, right?
Yeah, we've all gotten better at it. Yeah, I now know how to use a microphone, so it actually sounds good online, although I feel bad for anybody who watched any of my concerts before, like May.
Right, and you're becoming an expert on lighting, right?
Lighting, no, I really need to work on the lighting. My webcam still sucks, but my mic is good.
Yeah, I need to do something about that as well. But yeah, we're all learning. But what's not going to change is the economics of art production, unfortunately.
And that's another reason why to question the basic nature of the system that we're living under, because it is so completely failing in terms of anybody who's what we now call a content producer. Let's use a horrible term. But I mean, the arts have been all forms destroyed by modern capitalism. And it's not just about it's not just about the internet either. This is an important misconception a lot of people have, that it's just the nature of the internet that all these industries had to collapse. No, it's actually what we're doing with the internet and how the corporations are doing it, you know.
Yeah. It's not so much the internet as the people who are in charge and the goals they are attempting to achieve through it. You know, the internet is something that was created by corporations and the government, very much in partnership, very tight partnership, and it was created to achieve their goals of faster economic growth, of creation of new ways to produce growth and produce wealth. And so that's by and large the purpose that it has served. It doesn't have to serve that purpose, and there are ways to co-opt parts of that system for a larger community, but this is the reality in a sort of a market economy is what you're facing and what I'm facing. Sure.
Yeah. Eric Larson, it's been such a pleasure having you on again. It's been a fascinating conversation. Hopefully other people think so too.
Well, thanks again, Dave. And good luck. I hope I'll actually see you on tour one of these days soon.
I sure hope so. As soon as it's safe to sing in public without people fearing that I'm giving them COVID and all that, you know, yeah, people have to feel safe cramming into a room again. And the venues were already shrinking before the pandemic, and there's no room to be doing half filled shows, you know? Yeah.
Right. Well,
hope to see you on the road.
It's the number of heads in the audience, not the size of the room.
Well, that's true, right? Yeah, except when you're trying to actually, pay the bills on touring, and then it's both the number of heads in the audience and the size of the room, unfortunately, because right. the rent doesn't go down when the audiences shrink and the rooms shrink. Unfortunately, it's just the opposite. Yeah,
seems to be the case.
Thank you, Eric. Talk to you soon.
You too. Thanks once again.
And this has been another episode of Fifth Estate Live. And that was an interview with Eric Larson there in Western Massachusetts, who has a book coming out in the spring on PM Press called The Operating System, An Anarchist Theory of the Modern State. And it's going to be really good. And tomorrow at the same time, same channels, I'll be doing discussions with David, speaking with a wonderful organizer who lived for many years in Portland and now lives in Sacramento, named Ajamu Umi, who's also a regular writer about current events. And we'll have all sorts of wisdom on the current situation in the United States today for us. And then on Wednesday, tomorrow, Wednesday in the 4 o'clock Pacific, 7 o'clock Eastern, we're having a birthday celebration / memorial for Kevin Zeis and launching the Kevin Zeis Emerging Activist Fund. And I'll be singing a couple of songs on that. And then on Saturday, I will be doing a full-length concert on the internet at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on my YouTube and Facebook and Twitch and Twitter channels. And until tomorrow or whenever I see you all again, I'll see you then. And until then and after then, don't pay the rent. And remember, mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors and take care.